The headlines: at least 28 Palestinians, including 9 children, have been killed in 2 days of Israeli attacks on the besieged Gaza Strip. 2 Israelis are killed after a barrage of Palestinian retaliatory rockets struck Israel. And the EU's Brexit negotiator warns Britain to fully apply the terms of its exit from the bloc, particularly on fishing in Northern Ireland. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Israel has intensified its attacks on Gaza amid rising tensions between the two sides. Israeli jets pounded Gaza City as well as the town of Karara several times. The attacks left 2 people dead, bringing the Palestinian death toll from 2 days of airstrikes to 28. The victims include 1 woman and 9 children. On Tuesday, following an emergency meeting with military officials, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that his forces would increase the intensity and frequency of attacks. Earlier, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said that it conducted the biggest retaliatory attack against Israel. The group's military wing, Qassam Brigades, said it fired more than 40 rockets toward the cities of Ashdod and Ashkelon. It said the attacks were in response to Israel's airstrikes on Gaza's residential areas. According to the Israeli ambulance service chief, 2 people were killed in the strikes. The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent joining us from Gaza City. Ashraf, we're looking at a particular site, the skyline of Gaza, where somewhere has been hit because there's large plumes of black smoke billowing through the air. Where is that? What has been hit?
Well, if I see that correctly, I think somewhere in northern Gaza, near maybe in an Israeli fuel line or something in northern Gaza, because that picture in the skyline is not in Gaza City. It's all the way north of the enclave. It is possible that maybe a rocket that was fired from the Gaza Strip hit that Israeli oil reservoir in the north of the enclave, while Israel continues to pound the enclave since yesterday, and Palestinians are retaliating with scores of projectiles to retaliation to the Israeli attacks that have claimed the lives of more than at least 28 Palestinians, including 10 children.
When we take a look at what's happening, do you still get the sense that this is a continuing military attack on the Gaza Strip from Israel?
Definitely. This is an all-out war. This is Israel launched 3 wars since 2008 on the Gaza Strip, and I believe this is the fourth one. And the statements coming out from the Israeli media, quoting Israeli military press, that that Israel plans to launch more airstrikes against the Gaza Strip.
What have we heard from any of the resistance groups in terms of what types of plans they may have?
Well, the resistance factions in Gaza, including Hamas, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, and the Popular Resistance Committees, have all maintained that they will continue to retaliate until the Israeli regime stops its attacks against Gaza and stops its aggression in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Ashraf Shannon there from Gaza City, giving us the latest. Well, tensions are simmering in Jerusalem al-Quds, where Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The violence broke out on Friday, and since then, hundreds of Palestinians have been wounded. In response, Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has followed through on its promise, and it has sent a barrage of rockets into Israel.
More attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds
On Monday, over 300 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops fired rubber bullets on them around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Scores were detained by Israeli forces. The protests erupted after Israeli troops stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in an effort to force out the Palestinians. The violence around the mosque and the Old City were the worst since 2017, fueled by a years-long bid by Israeli settlers to take over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Israeli regime is also celebrating its 1967 occupation of Jerusalem al-Quds.
There are several facts here. One is that this is a process of, once again, of ethnic cleansing in broad daylight. It is a provocation, obvious provocation against Islam, and has appropriately been denounced by most Arab countries, including a couple of them who are overly anxious to normalize relations with Israel, and hopefully will now reconsider what they've done.
Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, the imam and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, has condemned the attack, calling the raid a heinous crime that cannot be tolerated. Leader of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, Mustafa Barghouti, called the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque compound a criminal act. Barghouti described the raid as a racist act by an apartheid regime.
Well, Israel is indisputably an apartheid state. It always has been from the outset, from 1948 on. It simply wasn't called that. The apartheid nature of Israel was confirmed in 1967 when it invaded the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Mustafa Barghouti is absolutely 100% right when he calls it a criminal act.
The military brigade of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, also warned against the presence of Israeli forces in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is so fluid, and resistance movements fired tens of rockets toward occupied Palestine Monday afternoon.
Well, attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds have been brutal and extreme. So far, around 800 Palestinians have been reported to have been wounded since the Israeli violence broke out on Friday. This violence is the worst in Jerusalem al-Quds since 2017. It is fueled by the looming eviction of several Palestinian families from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to make way for Israeli settlers.
The clashes in Al-Aqsa Mosque have drawn widespread condemnation from the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions, saying Israeli authorities must exercise maximum restraint. The U.S. government, however, stopped short of condemning the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan instead conveyed serious concern to his Israeli counterpart about violent confrontations in Jerusalem al-Quds. Arab nations, including Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, also hit out at Israel over the Jerusalem violence. Some Arab countries, including those that last year normalized relations with Israel, condemned the Israeli aggression. Iran, Pakistan, and many other nations also slammed the attack. In Britain, Germany, Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere, people took to the streets to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities and voice solidarity with the Palestinian people. In some countries like Oman, people gathered in front of the Israeli embassy to condemn the raids.
It's clear, I think, to the peoples of the world, even if it's not necessarily to the political classes in the Occident, in the West, that the Israeli regime is a criminal entity, and what they're seeing practiced against the Palestinian people, Palestinian worshippers, which is really a reflection of a process that's gone on for far too long and backed by Western governments, specifically Washington and its allies. So there's no surprise in the fact that people everywhere in the world are outraged.
The Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is nothing new. Israel has done similar acts in the past many times. Tel Aviv has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since its installment in the region by its Western creators. The regime enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular.
The reason that Israel was created in the first place was that it was meant to be a foothold for British expansion into the region and to the control of oil and gas, natural gas resources in the region.
What is clear is the fact that the Israeli aggression against Palestinians cannot end through dialogue. Israel has defied calls to stop violating the rights of Palestinians for decades. Many factions in Palestine have also come to the conclusion that Israel can be pushed back only through resistance and that any effort short of resistance will come to nothing given Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime at the UN Security Council, the only world body that can issue a binding resolution against the regime.
South Africans have joined the chorus of denunciation against Israel over its violence in the occupied Palestinian territories. Hundreds showed up to join the Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Cape Town. They chanted anti-Israel slogans while marching toward Parliament. And organizers said that they are campaigning for Parliament to adopt an anti-Israel boycott, divestment, and sanctions bill. Pro-Palestinian rallies have also been held in the Tunisian capital. In Pakistan, people hit the streets of the port city of Karachi to express solidarity with the Palestinians and denounce the Israeli violence against them. On Monday, similar protests were held in several other countries, including Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and Morocco. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has dismissed U.S. claims about a recent incident involving the two countries' vessels in the Strait of Hormuz. The IRGC said its patrol boats, while acting within the framework of maritime regulations, maintaining their legal distance, issued a warning to seven U.S. vessels on Monday. Said the U.S. vessels were engaging in unprofessional conduct, including flying helicopters, firing flares, and taking aimless, unnecessary, and provocative shots. The IRGC said the U.S. vessels rectified their conduct following the warning and continued on the way. The Pentagon chief had earlier claimed U.S. naval forces fired warning shots after IRGC boats harassed an American Navy submarine and escort ships. Iran says their legitimate U.S. presence is a source of instability and insecurity in the region, including in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz. At least nine people are killed after gunmen opened fire at a high school in the southwest Russian city of Kazan. Authorities say the victims include seven children and two adults, including a teacher. Earlier, Russian media cited official sources as saying that 11 people had died. At least 20 were also injured during the attack. Police say they detained a 19-year-old suspect 1 hour after the deadly incidents. There were also reports of explosions at the school. President Vladimir Putin has expressed his deep condolences to the families of the victims and has called for a review of the country's gun control laws. School shootings are rare in Russia due to normally tight security in educational institutions and the difficulty in possessing firearms legally. World Nurses Day is an opportunity to honor those who have put their lives at risk to save others. Over 100,000 Iranian nurses have been infected with the coronavirus since the outbreak of the disease in the country. Salman Kujuri has more.
A voice to lead, a vision for future. This is the theme for the 2021 World Nurses Day. Iran has commemorated the international occasion as this year, like the previous year, the occasion is marked with a new awareness among the public and officials as nurses, along with other health workers, take the front line in the fight against the deadly coronavirus pandemic. Speaking at a press conference on the occasion, head of Iran's nursing organization, Mohammad Mirza Beghi, said since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, over 100,000 Iranian nurses have been infected with the deadly virus, but Iranian nurses have not quit their jobs.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus epidemic, Iranian nurses have been at the forefront of the fight against the disease. More than 100,000 of them have so far caught the virus on duty, out of which 120 died of the virus. On average, 6,000 to 7,000 nurses are under quarantine due to getting infected with the virus. But as soon as they get recovered, they come back to work to take care of the patients. Such a spirit creates a beautiful picture of sacrifice in one's mind.
There are some 140,000 nurses in Iran. For hospital nurses, life under the coronavirus conditions has been much tougher and more challenging. These professional nurses have had to work extra shifts to make up for the shortage of staff.
I've been a nurse for 12 years, but the COVID-19 pandemic was the worst of what I had ever seen. I saw my colleagues losing their lives on a daily basis at the front line of the fight against the virus. Therefore, I decided to take photos of their sacrifices and hard-working efforts to take care of infected patients. My photo was selected by the International Council of Nurses as the best photo of the year in hospital category.
This global COVID-19 pandemic has shown the world the important role that nurses play in keeping people healthy across the lifespan. Therefore, nurses as the largest healthcare profession must play an integral part in planning the future of healthcare.
The World Health Organization designated 2020 as the Year of Nurses to celebrate the contributions of nurses to healthcare during the pandemic and acknowledge the challenges they continue to face as the pandemic ebbs and flows through human community worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Popular tradition in Iran is to cook traditional food and give away to other people on different occasions. Some people make a vow with God and prepare foods and donate among others. The custom is mostly observed to feed those who are needy. Human Abadi has more.
On different occasions, especially during the holy month of Ramadan or on the martyrdom anniversary of Shia Imams, Iranians make a vow with their God to do something for charity. Hence, if their needs are met, they donate votive offerings as a public service. Type of food and its amount depends to the maker of the vow, who may be a rich person from the middle class or even from the poor. The popular places to fulfill the vows are mosques and the shrines of Shia Imams. The shrine of the 8th Shia Imam in the northeastern city of Mashhad is very famous for distributing food among pilgrims and the needy. Officials told us that most of the people who help in cooking and preparing the votive food are khadim or servant. It means they do not get wages. These people work to fulfill their own vows, which are to give free service to the pilgrims.
Every day, 100 men and 100 women work here without getting salaries. They work just for the sake of their love for Imam Reza. Once a week, they come here to help us. It means that these 100 people who are working now would return next week. Tomorrow, another group will join us.
Almost 20,000 packs of iftar meal are also prepared and distributed among people every day at Imam Reza's shrine. Some 30,000 servings are also cooked outside the shrine by charity organizations in collaboration with Imam Reza's shrine management.
A very nice tradition in Iran during the holy month of Ramadan is Nazri or Vodi food. People make food and distribute it among others for free. The reason for that is that they have a vow with their God to feed other people. Human Abadi, the holy city of Mashhad.
And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. the month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. The hours and moments of the blessed month of Ramadan helped us contemplate over our deeds. These hours were the best times for supplicating and being in communion with God. As we are going through the last days and hours of this month, we had better reckon our past deeds. Islam has put high emphasis on reckoning one's deeds every day in a bid to make amends for evil deeds and try to refrain from moral defects. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says to his companion Abu Zar, "O Abu Zar, reckon yourself before being reckoned, because this will make your reckoning easier on the Day of Judgment. And evaluate yourself before being evaluated, and make yourself prepared for the Day of Judgment, as nothing will be hidden on that day. O Abu Zar, nobody will be considered among the God-weary until reckoning himself harder than reckoning one's partner, so that he will know where he has gained his food and drink and clothes from. Has he gained them from halal or haram sources? O Abu Zar, he who is heedless of the divine laws and is careless of where he attains money from, God too, will not disdain which way to make him enter in the hell." If you remember, now we are going to discuss Zakat-e-Fitr or Fitriye, which is related to Eid al-Fitr or the Feast of Fitr, which falls on the first day of the Islamic month of Shawwal. Eid al-Fitr is the feast that is the day which God has granted the faithful after 1 month of fasting and obeying His commands. Fitriye is the alms that every faithful should give to the poor as a sign of gratitude for Eid al-Fitr. Fitriye, unlike fidyeh or ransom that we discussed in the previous episode, can be paid both in cash and food. The amount of fitriyeh is 3 kilograms of usually eaten food for each person. In view of this, usually the faithful pay the equal price of 3 kilograms of wheat or rice for each person. It is highly recommended to pay the fitriyeh before the Eid al-Fitr prayer, but if it is not paid before the prayer, one can pay it later. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says on the blessed month of Ramadan, "The month of Ramadan is like a part of paradise in which God makes us enter in the burning hell of the material world, and He gives us the respite to admit ourselves in this divine banquet in this month. Some people enter paradise only for those 30 days. Some others, thanks to the blessing of these 30 days, stay in paradise for the whole year. And others stay in paradise for the whole life. Still others pass by it negligently, which is the cause of regret and loss. Let us not be of the negligent and astray. The condition for keeping the paradise of Ramadan by ourselves and attain sustenance of its light is to persist in doing righteous deeds and observing sincerity in action. Do righteous deeds only for God's satisfaction and not people's satisfaction." Thank you. Dear listeners, let us recite the supplication for the eve of the 29th of Ramadan. O coverer of the night over the day, and coverer of the day over the night, O knowing, O wise, O Lord of the lords and master of the masters, there is no God except you. O nearer to me than my jugular vein, O God, O God, O God, the best names, the loftiest parables, and grandeur and bounties belong to you. I ask you to bless Muhammad and his progeny, and place my name on this night among the successful, and my spirit with the martyrs, and my good deed at the highest point of paradise, and my evil deeds forgiven. And I plead to you to grant me certitude, which accompanies with my heart and faith, which takes doubt away from me, and make me satisfied with what you have distributed for me, and give us good in the world, and good in the hereafter, and guard us against the punishment of burning fire, and give me a sustenance on this night, your remembrance and your gratitude, and enthusiasm toward you, and returning to you, and assisting me in what you have assisted Muhammad and progeny of Muhammad. Greetings to him and them.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Cowspiracy, directed by Kip Anderson and Keegan Coon. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Anthony Hamilton, who is a vegan, SWP member and student activist. Now, Cowspiracy is a groundbreaking documentary that contends that industrial animal agriculture is the leading cause of deforestation, water consumption, pollution, and even plays a far greater role in global warming than the transportation industry. Cowspiracy manages to expose the capitalist nature and the privatization of the Western food industry, which seeks to protect private company owners and large environmental groups that link back to Congress.
Do you think there should be any concern of us making this documentary?
Of course. If you don't realize right now that you're putting your neck on the chopping block, you know, you better take that camera and throw it away.
It's an environmental disaster, that's being ignored by the very people who should be championing.
Let's look at the fundamental problem here.
No one wants to talk about it.
Because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions.
The leading cause of environmental degradation is...
We need to address that as well.
It's not up to the Department of Water Resources.
Hard to actually target, like, one thing.
I don't necessarily know what it is.
There's suppression and mismanagement of information everywhere it abounds.
It starts at the local level, but then it goes all the way to Congress.
When you consider the devastation it's having on our planet as well as the oceans.
We're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of species in 65 million years.
And they can dictate the federal policies because they have so much political power.
And one of the largest industries on the planet with biggest environmental impact. Trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating.
That's the one thing no one talks about. You know, everybody goes around that.
Unfortunately, we are no longer able to fund your film project. We had a meeting, and due to the growing controversial subject matter, we have some concerns that have to pull out.
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources, and you have nothing.
A lot of people just keep their mouths shut because they don't want to be the next one with the bullet to their head.
I don't know that I would want to comment on that.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And I must say, I found this documentary to be very shocking, thought-provoking, and disturbing all at the same time. And you really do feel a great sense of urgency after watching this documentary to address environmental issues. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic. This documentary was re-released a few years ago, but it's still highly watched and highly relevant to today. What was your take on it?
Well, very much so, and everything that you've mentioned, that and all the above and more, really. And it's quite an impressive first-time feature for these guys. And what they do, which is really interesting, is rather than going for meat-eaters and putting them off, which is the obvious thing, they go for the environmental agencies and groups and basically question them as to why they aren't campaigning about this issue, which is greatly affects global warming. I mean, it's pretty shocking. What they also do is, through humour and sparing shock tactics, get the message across too.
He's also on a personal journey, as we learn watching this documentary. He gets very involved, and I thought that was a good style.
Yeah, we've seen it with Michael Moore, but here it's less about him and more about keeping on point and on the question. And some of the stuff is really jaw-dropping.
We'll see that a bit later on. And Anthony, what was your take on the film?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. Like you said, about the lack of shock tactics really then allows you to engage in it without feeling as if you're morally obliged to, you know, have to straight away get behind it without seeing the facts and figures and everything like that. So I thought in that sense, you know, it was quite good. It was very critical of the charities, of the people who are supposed to be doing something about this. It was very critical about the lobbyists as well behind it, trying to show the systematic nature of what's going on. I also do think there were a few problems with it. He does seem to pose a lot of the climate change activists against a lot of what he's actually trying to find out, which I think is, you know, a dangerous thing to fall into. In that he seems to target the people who are challenging climate change already and the, you know, mm-hmm. activists against fossil fuels and things like this mm-hmm. as being part of the problem because they're not acknowledging so much the, you know, the stuff around the mm-hmm. agriculture industry. And I think it's a bit of a problem. A better way to do it would be to actually link the two together and say this should be a united fight.
But of course he implies in the documentary that they're sort of in cahoots perhaps behind the scenes with the political establishment, and that's why they're afraid to speak on this issue. But we'll talk about that a bit more later on as we show the clips in regard to that part of the programme. So, Maria, if I could just turn to you. Do you think, before watching this documentary, were you aware that the animal agriculture industry had such a profound effect on global warming?
No, I wasn't. And having seen Al Gore's two films, even less so, because he doesn't tackle it either. And in the film, he is the main inspiration for Kip Anderson. And if this is as important, as huge as these filmmakers are saying, and the film is trying to say, then why aren't the likes of Al Gore tackling this or mentioning it, even just one line in his two films?
And Anthony, I mean, before we move on to our next clip, Do you think this documentary at least makes meat eaters think twice and think about becoming vegan, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it definitely has that, because it shows about, you know, there's a lot of talk about individual responsibility and things like that, but it does break it down in quite very obvious terms, uses a lot of nice infographs and stuff, which actually shows your impact on the world, the impact of the meat industry and so on. So I think it does actually, it's really good at exposing that and actually showing people the evidence and letting them make their choice for themselves as well.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to leave it there just for now.
Clearly, the government did not want to talk about this issue. Their inability to answer, along with the environmental organization's silence on the topic of animal agriculture, made it seem something more was going on. I started doing more investigating on the impacts of livestock and found out the situation was actually worse than I had thought. In 2009, two advisors from the World Bank released an analysis on human-induced greenhouse gases, finding that animal agriculture was responsible not for 18%, as the UN stated, but was actually 51% of all greenhouse gases, 51%, yet all we hear about is burning fossil fuels. This devastating figure is due to clear-cutting rainforest for grazing, respiration, and all the waste animals produce. This makes animal agriculture the number one contributor to human-caused climate change. But not only that, I found out raising animals for food consumes a third of all the planet's freshwater, occupies up to 45% of the Earth's land, is responsible for up to 91% of Amazon destruction, is a leading cause of species extinction, ocean dead zones, and habitat destruction. Yet, the world's largest environmental groups that are supposed to be saving our world didn't mention this anywhere. I had to speak with environmental organizations to find out why they weren't addressing this issue.
Really, some mind-boggling statistics there. Maria, if we could go back to you, do you think the filmmakers were successful in this film in conveying the threats the environment is under?
I think they were. For me, the most shocking was the fact that Greenpeace wouldn't speak to Kim Anderson, which is just mind-boggling. And why these organisations aren't fighting or bringing these subjects onto, you know, tackling the government over it, but that sort of Michael Moore-ish type sort of assault on the Greenpeace's offices spoke volumes. And then the emails that the correspondence that he received say, oh, we're not this time, you know, not we can't help you this time. You know, when this is, you know, a great opportunity for them to talk out, you know, to speak out and say something.
And Anthony, if I could turn to you now and to address the issues, the main issues raised in this documentary. Of course, what is the link between the animal industrial agriculture industry and also the impact it has on global warming?
Well, I mean, a lot of what was just shown in that clip there, you know, the deforestation, the destruction of habitats, the species extinction, all of these things contribute in a major way. And if you consider this industry, it is an industry. It has, you know, huge, huge amounts of waste, huge amounts of pollution, huge amounts of taking up land simply to grow crops to feed the animals who also take up land as well. It's an incredibly destructive cycle that actually does, you know, I mean, it was very interesting when he spoke to the Oceana person and they said about ethical fishing and so on, but I mean, when he talks, he goes through it in detail, there's not really such a thing as the sustainable fishing which they talk about. Mm-hmm. Every which way in which the industry constantly expands is destructive.
Mm-hmm. It is a myth, that's what he suggests in the documentary, yeah. Which is surprising to hear. So are you suggesting, is there a link between capitalism and global warming? I mean, do you think it's our over-consumer society that is to blame for all these unsustainable methods we're taking?
Absolutely. And if you think about the entire fundamental point in capitalism is about overproduction. It's about constant expansion, finding new fields and areas to be able to conquer and dominate and sell to people. And if you look at the meat industry, the agriculture industry, it is one of those industries which is just growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And, you know, with globalization comes that then domination of the globe with this, you know, huge empire behind it, huge amount of lobbyist money. I think that's, you know, he goes and challenges a lot of leaders of, like you said, Greenpeace and so on. I think that's brilliant, because holding them to account over it really shows the power that this industry has behind it as well.
Maria, do you think the filmmaker puts off people who eat meat from taking part in helping the environment, or do you think he does it in a way that's clever for us to help the environment?
No, I think he was quite clever in the way he put it across, because we've seen in other films, you know, where, you know, you see these animals and the way they're treated and the inhumane conditions and everything. But here he's showing what the consequences are and the effects to us and to our planet and what we're doing. And it does make you sort of self-conscious about it. And I think meat eaters will think twice whether or not the term vegan is another matter. Mm-hmm. But they will take a harder look at what we're doing to our planet.
I mean, we're told constantly to use less water, to change our light bulbs, to recycle. And Anthony, I mean, shouldn't the onus be on the people in positions of power, rather, than the individual to help combat climate change?
Completely. I mean, the idea about just doing small individual things like taking shorter showers and switching off lights and things, while, you know, it is a good activity to get into, it's not going to create the fundamental change which is actually going to save the planet. The fundamental change needs to come from these mass organisations. It actually needs to come from system change in reality, because the way in which this industry is set up, it is to make profit, it is to expand, and it is to not look at the side effects of what they're actually creating, the consequences, which is, you know, constant heating of the globe, constant destruction of rainforests and so on.
And as this documentary suggests also, when you're up against this mass production machine, it's really futile trying to help the environment on an individual level.
Couldn't understand why the world's largest environmental organizations were not addressing this when their entire mission is to help protect the environment.
But that's the thing too, is they say, you know, use less coal, ride your bike, not, you know, less meat.
Yeah. I think they focus grouped it and it's a political loser. In terms of, yeah, because they're membership organizations, you know, a lot of them. They're looking to maximize the number of people making contributions, and if they get identified as being anti-meat or challenging people on their everyday habits, that's something that's so dear to people that it will hurt with their fundraising.
They do not want to address the primary driving cause of environmental devastation, which is animal agriculture, because they're businesses and they want to make sure that they have a reliable source of funding.
I was invited to a meeting with Al Gore and some years ago now, and made these methane arguments, and he was really pushback. And that's just his argument. It's hard enough to get people to think about CO2. Don't confuse them.
I think that the problem with a lot of organizations that are focused and have a laser focus don't go off message because they don't want to piss off another whole group of people that will make their lives difficult.
Maria, so if animal agriculture is a leading cause of global warming, why has there been so much silence about this issue? I mean, do you think, as the documentary suggests, there's a conspiracy or cowspiracy happening here?
Well, clearly something's happening, and there's a lot of invested interest, according to the film, because the fact that environmental agencies aren't taking up the cause, and that comment about Al Gore was priceless. You know, he's in a great position to have included that in his follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth in An Inconvenient Sequel, and he didn't touch it.
They mentioned that in this documentary, actually, that even Al Gore allegedly didn't want to go there as a politician. He knew that it wouldn't help the cause.
But you have to make it the cause. That's what I couldn't get my head around, you know, and that's the thing about this filmmaker. He keeps on message, and he keeps telling you this, and he keeps showing you, talking to all these different organisations. You know, I understand lobbyists. I would expect that from them, and to a certain extent from the government. But from environmental groups, you know, that was the shocker.
I was very surprised to watch that also. And Anthony, do you think, as the documentary suggests, that major environmental groups are purposefully turning a blind eye to the effects of animal agriculture on the environment? I mean, do you think they have any vested interests?
It seemed that way. I mean, from the people he tried to talk to, it was constantly evading his questions. There were times when people, they just went silent and couldn't actually answer his questions. You could tell that they wanted to say something, but it was as if something was stopping them. And I think, you know, there is an unseen power that lies behind these industries, where that pressure, that level of fear that the charities hold over being able to speak out about it is clearly an incredibly pressing issue on them. And I think at the heart of it, one of the things which someone said in the VT just there was that they are businesses and they have funding. And if you look at Kip making this film, he had his funding pulled halfway through the film because they said it was becoming too controversial. You know, as soon as these people, the agriculture industry, feels as if something is going to crush their profits and stop their profits in any way, they straight away jump on top of it and stop it from happening.
And another
interesting was that he tackles one of the pro-agriculture people and says, have you invested money? Have you funded Greenpeace or one of those organisations? And she, like, stops dead and says, I'd rather not answer that question, or something along those lines, which kind of suggests that they do.
It speaks volumes. Well, so either they plead ignorance or they're trying to hide something. And Maria, one of the other shocking things we find out from this documentary is the food disparagement law, which effectively gags people from speaking out against the animal industry. In several states, it's a law that makes it easy for food producers to sue their critics for libel. So who knew speaking against the beef industry would land you in so much trouble?
Indeed, yes, that's a $64,000 question. The fact that they went after Oprah and lost, again, speaks volumes to a certain extent. And the fact that she was sued along with Howard Lyman, who says in the film that if that had happened now, speaking the truth, he would have been, he would have lost.
He would have lost, yes. So he's probably lucky that Oprah was behind him on that.
Exactly, or that the Patriot Act wasn't around at that time, maybe.
Were you surprised to know this also, Anthony?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the person who was sued as well alongside Oprah, he himself had ran a farm.
Well, exactly.
A massive, massive farm. And it was him who then actually realised what was going on behind the scenes and tried to speak out about it, just speaking the truth. Mm. And straight away it was clamped down on. And obviously he doing that was an individual. Then it becomes the onus of what are these organisations doing? Actually, they have the clout behind them. They have the membership. They have the power to do something. So it does actually make you think what is going on behind the scenes.
We'll have to pause you there for now.
Animal agriculture industry is one of the most powerful industries on the planet. I think most people in this country are aware of the influence of money and industry on politics, and we really see that clearly on display with this industry in particular. Most people would be shocked to learn that animal rights and environmental activists are the number one domestic terrorism threat, according to the FBI.
And why is that?
It's a difficult question to answer, why these groups are at the top of the FBI's priorities. I think a big part of it is that they, more than really any other social movements today, are directly threatening corporate profits. You know, when we try to find out how factory farms and how animal agriculture is polluting the environment, they try to claim exemptions to that information, either under national security terms or public safety, trademark issues, business. It's a business secret. We've seen all these attempts to keep people in the dark about what they're actually doing. You know, one of the largest industries on the planet, with the biggest environmental impact, trying to keep us in the dark about how it's operating. Through the Freedom of Information Act, we obtained documents from the Counterterrorism Unit that show they were monitoring my lectures, media interviews like this one, my website, my book.
Are we at risk filming this and showing it?
You're going up against people that have massive legal resources. I mean, it's just overwhelming, the amount of money at their disposal, and you have nothing. And I think that fear is a big part of the tactic as well.
Will was right. I was scared. When I learned about the activists being killed in Brazil, I was disturbed, but I felt removed. But to learn about American activists and journalists being targeted by the industry and FBI, my funding being dropped, I was genuinely worried and it hit close to home. Was this why no one was willing to talk about the issue? I decided to take precautionary measures with all the footage I shot.
We also learn from the documentary that at least 1,000 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil over the last 20 years. Maria, we see Kip Anderson becoming increasingly more nervous and paranoid in the making of this documentary because of what he's up against as he digs deeper. Do you think the filmmakers were brave in making this film?
In some ways, yes. Because once you put your head above the parapet, then, you know, you're in that danger zone. And it's something that's very important and it's critical that people know about it. So, you know, kudos to them and to him to carry on with making this film, because it's such a vitally important subject. You know?
Do you really think that their lives were at risk, or were they dramatising it, perhaps?
It's hard to say. The fact that their funding was removed and the fact that the FBI apparently, you know, targets journalists isn't a surprise as such, but I don't know. Verdict's still out on that one.
And Anthony, we hear that according to the FBI, environmental and animal rights activists are considered the number one domestic threat. Why are you surprised to know this?
I was incredibly surprised, I mean, given how explosive the world has become, given how turbulent the times that we live in are, if you consider, I mean, you know, this film was made a few years ago, but there are still so many other pressing issues, where there are mass movements about it, where there are protest groups, where there's everything. It's a surprise to see environmental activists and you know, activists against the agriculture industry being up there at the top. I mean, a lot of the time these are people who are in small groups until it breaks through into a much larger thing, like maybe the People's Climate March and that sort of stuff. But until that happens, they're very small groups of people, so it is quite a shocking thing to hear.
I want to bring in Donald Trump now as we end near the end of the program. I mean, he's been criticized for not taking climate change seriously, and he has a record of making some bold tweets, and he's even claimed in one tweet that perhaps China is responsible for global warming as some sort of conspiracy against the U.S. Anthony, what do you make of Trump's environmental policies?
I mean, I just don't think he knows what he's talking about, really. He has access to a social media account which has possibly the biggest platform in the world right now, and he's able to say whatever he wants, whatever pops into his head at any time without listening to any advisors. And really, it just seems like he doesn't know anything that he's talking about, and everything is always an external enemy. He never does anything wrong. There's nothing wrong with the United States. You know, when it comes to Kim Jong-un and North Korea as well, it's them who are the aggressive ones with the missiles and everything like that. So it's always, there's someone else that's the problem, and it's he's never able to look inwards.
And Mary, what would you say the ultimate message of this documentary is?
Well, that we should all turn vegan, really, if we want to save the planet.
So cutting out meat or eating less is not enough, apparently.
Apparently not.
To reverse the damage that has been caused. Well, I'm afraid it was a really great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there for now. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. And thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
We'll be right back. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.